You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler.
Volume 2. The National Socialist Movement. The individual soldier is not instructed in high-level strategic planning. Instead, he is trained for rigid discipline and a fanatical belief in the justice and strength of his cause, and this makes him totally devoted to the cause without any reservations. The same thing must be taught to the individual follower of a movement so that he knows it is important and he is fighting for a great future and a supreme purpose. An army would be worthless if it only consisted of generals. A political movement that upholds a world concept is equally worthless if it tries to be a reservoir of thinking people. No, it needs the discipline of the simple soldier as well. The survival of any organization depends on the service of a broad and emotionally driven mass of people who are willing to serve as supreme intellectual leadership. It is more difficult to maintain discipline with a company of 200 equally intelligent men than to maintain discipline with a company of 190 with less intellectual capacity and only 10 educated men among them. In the past, the social democracy Marxist movement has used this fact to their great benefit. It recruited from the masses our discharged soldiers who were already accustomed to discipline. The Marxists took them under its own equally rigid discipline. Its organization was an army that consisted of both officers and soldiers. But here, the German laborer who was now discharged from the army was the soldier, and the Jewish intellectual became the officer, and the German trade union officials could be considered the non-commissioned officers. Our privileged class was always shaking their heads in confusion when they saw that only the so-called uneducated masses belonged to Marxism. They failed to realize this was the reason for its success. While the intellectual privileged class parties formed a useless and undisciplined mob, Marxism used the non-intellectuals to form an army of party soldiers who blindly obeyed their Jewish masters as they had once obeyed their German officers. The German middle class thought they were above worrying about the mental reasoning of the ignorant lower classes, so they paid no attention to them. They also failed to consider the potential consequences or to realize the deeper meaning, and they certainly failed to see the danger that existed in this recruitment of the masses. On the contrary, they believed that a political movement that consisted only of intellectuals was superior simply because it was an intellectual movement. They assumed a group of intellectuals had more of a right and a greater chance of gaining power than the uneducated masses would possibly have. They never realized that the strength of a political party is not found in the great intelligence of individual members, but rather strength is in the disciplined obedience of the members who follow their intellectual leadership. What counts is the leadership itself. If two bodies of troops are fighting, the victor will not be the one whose individual members have the most advanced strategical training. The winner will be the one with the superior leadership and with better disciplined, more blindly obedient, and better drilled troops. This is a basic principle that we must constantly keep in view when testing the possibility of moving a world concept into action and making it a reality. Now that we know we must transform a world concept into a fighting movement in order to lead it to victory, it is logical that the movement's program must consider the human resources at its disposal. On one hand, the ultimate goals and guiding ideas of the movement must be firmly fixed and immovable. On the other hand, the propaganda of the recruiting program must adapt to appeal to those whose help is necessary for success. This propaganda must be brilliant and psychologically sound when adapted to the target audience. Without them, even the most brilliant idea would always remain just an idea. If the race-based nationalist idea is to grow from a vague thought to a clear success, it must carefully select certain guiding principles and ideas calculated by nature and substance to attract and hold a great mass of men. Only this mass can guarantee these ideas in the form of a world concept that will be fought for. This mass is the German working class. For this reason, the program of the new movement was summed up in a handful of guiding principles, 25 in all. They are intended to give a rough picture of the movement's intent to the ordinary man of the people. They are, to a certain extent, a political profession of faith. On one hand, they are to gain followers for the movement, and on the other hand, they are to unite those followers by welding the recruits together by giving them a common obligation. The following realization is important and must always be remembered. The program of the movement is beyond questioning and is absolutely sound in its ultimate aims. But since it has to be written down based on what was thought at the time, the opinion may eventually arise that perhaps certain principles should be worded differently and better formulated. This is usually disastrous because it takes something that should be unshakably firm and opens it to discussion. If we allow a single point to be dragged outside the realm of a strict doctrine, discussion will not produce a new, better, and unified formulation. It is far more likely to lead to endless debate and general chaos. In such a case, the alternatives must always be weighed. Which is better? A new and more succinct formula that causes a dispute within the movement, or a form that is less than perfect but establishes a logical, unshakable, inwardly unified entity? If carefully considered, the unshakable entity will always be preferred. Since changes are only a matter of outward form, making corrections may seem desirable or even possible over and over again. Due to men's focus on the outward appearance, there is great danger that they may see this external reformatting of a program as the main business of a movement and assume the goal is to tinker with the program. But if that is the focus, the will and strength to fight for the idea will diminish, and the energy that should be directed against the outside world is consumed by internal battles over the program. If the broad outline of the doctrine is actually sound, and it has, up to this point, been considered a rock-solid law, it is not nearly as harmful to keep a formula that is less than ideal or may not agree exactly with the truth than to try improving it by opening it up to discussions that may have damaging consequences. Revisions must be absolutely avoided as long as the movement itself is still struggling for victory. How are we to fill men with blind faith in the truth of a doctrine if we spread uncertainty and doubt by constantly making changes to it? We must always seek the inner meaning of the doctrine and not become distracted by the outer shape. This inner core is unchangeable, and for its own sake we can only hope that by keeping away all actions that divide and create doubt, the movement may gain the strength necessary to maintain itself. Here too we can learn from the Catholic Church. Although its dogma unnecessarily conflicts sometimes with science on many points, the Church is not willing to sacrifice one syllable of this dogma. It rightly realizes that its strength is not in adjusting to match the scientific results of the moment, which are constantly changing, but in firm devotion to doctrines that are established and form its character of faith. It is more solid today than ever because of this. We may safely foretell that as events become more fleeting and they begin to change faster, the strong and stable fixed pole of the Church will attract even greater numbers of the blindly devoted. Anyone who truly and seriously desires the victory of a new race-based world concept must realize that only a movement that is capable of fighting is equipped to succeed, and that such a movement can hold its own only if it is built on an unshakable, impregnable, and solid program. In formulating its program, the movement must never dare to make concessions to the passing spirit of the times, but must always maintain the form that has been decided as the right one, or at least maintain it until the movement is victorious. Until this has happened, any attempt to introduce arguments about the suitability of some point of the program will shatter the unity and fighting strength of the movement in the same degree its followers participate in such inner discussions. An improvement, carried out today, might be subjected to renewed critical scrutiny tomorrow, and possibly another, better substitute found the day after. Anyone who allows this to happen opens up a road whose beginning he knows, but whose end is lost in a boundless expanse. This important realization had to be used in the young Nationalist Socialist movement. In the program of the 25 points, the National Socialist German Workers' Party has a foundation that must remain unshakable. The movement's present and future members must never feel it is their task to rework these guiding principles, but must feel duty-bound to them as they stand. Otherwise, the next generation might waste its strength on similar, purely formal work within the party instead of bringing new followers and new power to the movement. For the great number of followers, the essence of our movement will be less in the words of our doctrine and more in the meaning we give them. The Young Movement originally owed its name to these considerations. The program was later drawn up in accordance with these, and that was how the circle of ideas became rooted. To bring victory to the new race-based ideas, it was necessary to create a people's party, a party consisting not just of intellectual leaders, but of manual workers too. Any attempt to accomplish the new racialist ideas of thought without this forceful organization would be useless today and forever, just as it has proven to be in the past. Therefore, it is the movement's right and its duty to consider itself the champion and the embodiment of these ideas. The basic ideas of the National Socialist movement are race-based. Racialism is National Socialism. If National Socialism is to conquer, it must declare this set of ideas absolutely and exclusively as its own. Here too, it has the duty and the right to stress that any attempt to maintain the race-based idea outside the confines of the National Socialist German Workers' Party is pointless and impossible, and, in most cases, such claims are outright fraud. If anyone today accuses the movement of acting as if it owned the race-based idea, there is just one single answer. We not only own it, but for all practical purposes, we created it. Nothing that previously existed under the name of racialist was fit to influence the destiny of our people in the slightest, because these ideas all lacked clear, unified formulation. In most cases, these ideas were a collection of mere isolated, disconnected convictions, which varied in their soundness. They often contradicted one another and never had any cohesion among themselves. Even if this cohesion had existed, it was too weak to build a movement from. This is what the National Socialist movement accomplished alone. Today, all kinds of societies, big and small, even great parties, lay claim to the word racialist. This is a result of what our National Socialist movement has accomplished. If it had not been for our work, none of these organizations would ever have dreamed of even saying the word racialist. The word would have meant nothing to them and been incomprehensible to their leaders. It was only the work of the NSDAP, National Socialist German Workers' Party, that made this concept into a meaningful word, and now everyone uses it. Our party's successful work in enlisting support through its propaganda has shown the power of racialist ideas. Others are forced, if only by their greed, to gain new members to at least pretend they want something similar. It is the same old story. They exploited our work to help their party at the elections. For them, the word racialist is just a superficial, empty catchword that they use to counter the attraction their members have for our National Socialist movement. They are concerned for their own movements and fear our movement which is carried by a new worldview of universal significance, a significance which is so great that they can only speculate about the true meaning, and that they can only suspect how dangerous it is for one party to be the exclusive torchbearer of this idea. It is only this fear for their own survival and alarm at the rise of a movement supported by a new world concept that makes them use this new word of racialist. 8 years ago, they didn't even know this word. 7 years ago, they laughed at it. 6 years ago, they called it stupid. 5 years ago, they fought it. 4 years ago, they hated it. 3 years ago, they put it on trial. Finally, 2 years ago, they added it to their vocabulary as their own war cry for their battle. Even today, we have to keep pointing out that none of these parties has any clue what the German people actually need. The most striking proof of this is the superficial way they use the word racialist. All those fake racialists roaming around with hybrid ideas are just as dangerous. They build fantastic plans based on nothing more than a concept. It may sound like a good idea, but alone it is totally meaningless and cannot be used to lead a great unified fighting fellowship, and it is certainly unfit to build one. These people who brew together a program, partly from their own thinking and partly from what they have read in other programs, are often more dangerous than those who admit they are enemies of the racialist idea. The best among these fake racialists are unproductive theorists. But even here, most of them strut arrogantly toward disaster. They often believe they can cover up their spiritual and intellectual nonsense and their instability by hiding behind a flowing beard and a distracting people with primitive Germanic gesturing. To contrast all these unsuccessful attempts, it is a good time for us to recall when the young National Socialist movement began its struggle. Chapter 6. The Struggle of the Early Days, the Importance of Speeches. The first great meeting on February the 24th, 1920, in the Hofbrauhaus Banquet Hall was still fresh in our minds when we began preparing for the next meeting. Previously, we thought it was a bad idea to hold a small meeting once every 2 weeks or even once a month in a city the size of Munich. But we were now planning to have a great mass meeting once a week. One fear and one alone kept troubling us. Would people come and would they listen to us? I personally was unshakably convinced, even then, that once people are there, they will stay and listen to what we had to say. During those meetings, the Munich Hofbrauhaus Banquet Hall became almost sacred to us. It was the place where we had a meeting every week, and every week it was filled with more attentive people than the time before. We started with war guilt, about the responsibility for the war, and at that time the general public did not think about it much. They did not care. We went through the peace treaties. Almost everything that was discussed seemed to stir the crowd, which made it appropriate material for campaigning. With strong interest all around, we paid particular attention to the peace treaties. Again and again, our young movement had been foretelling to the great masses of people what would fall on their heads, and now almost every prophecy had been fulfilled. Today it is easy to talk or write about those things, but in those days, before our first big meetings, a public mass meeting that embraced the irritations of the working classes, instead of demonstrating privileged class weaknesses and dealt with the Peace Treaty of Versailles, was viewed the same as an attack on the Republic and a sign of die-hard monarchy supporters. At the very first sentence that criticized the Versailles Treaty, the speaker could expect to be the target of the stereotypical interruption. And Brest-Litovsk? Brest-Litovsk! The crowd would keep roaring this again and again until it gradually became hoarse, or the speaker gave up trying to convince them of whatever his point was. One could have beaten his head against the wall, sympathizing with the misery of these poor people. The crowd would not listen and would not understand that Versailles was a shame and a disgrace, and the demands it made amounted to an unheard-of plundering of our people. the Marxists had worked their destruction, and the enemy propaganda poisoned our people beyond the reach of reason. We were not even allowed to complain about this disgrace openly. Who were we, little Germans, to complain about anything when there was such immeasurable guilt on the other side? What had the privileged class done to stop this dreadful collapse, to oppose it, and to clear the path for truth by better and more complete understanding? Nothing. And nothing. In those days, the great racialist apostles, which we see all around today, were nowhere to be seen. They may have been talking in clubs or at tea parties among their own like-minded circles, but they never ventured among the wolves where they should have been. The only time they were with the wolves was when they had an opportunity to howl with them. I realized that the question of war guilt must be clarified through historical truth for the small group that made up the party. Providing an understanding of the peace treaty to the great masses was an indispensable step toward the movement's success in the future. In those days, the masses still saw the peace as a success for democracy. It was necessary to make a stand against the treaty, and the first step was burning ourselves into the people's minds forever as an enemy of that treaty. Later, when bitter reality revealed the real deception and exposed the hatred concealed in the treaty, the memory of our earlier attitude would win us the confidence of the masses. Even then, I always advocated making a stand against misguided public attitudes, regardless of whether it was popular at the time or even if it generated hatred. I was ready to start the battle. The NSDAP must not be a follower of public opinion, but must become the master of public opinion. It must not be the masses' servant, but their lord. When a movement is still weak, there is naturally a great temptation to follow the crowd and join in the shouting by using the slogans and battle cries of the enemy. This temptation comes at a time when an overwhelmingly superior challenger has already succeeded through seductive deceit, in forcing the people to make crazy decisions or form incorrect beliefs. This is true especially when the young movement believes there are a few obvious slogans used by the enemy that seem to speak for the new movement equally well. Human cowardice accepts such arguments eagerly if it believes they give it justification for expressing its own point of view, even if it is following in the criminal footsteps of the enemy. Several times I have been in situations where it took extreme energy not to let the ship of the movement drift into artificially created currents or from actually sailing right into them. The last time was when our hellish press, the Hecuba of the existence of the German nation, succeeded in blowing the problem of South Tyrol out of proportion, which could be disastrous to the German people. Without stopping to think about exactly who they were working for, many so-called nationalist men and parties and societies joined the general outcry out of weakness when they were faced with the public opinion that had been thoroughly inflamed by the Jews. This helped to senselessly strengthen the attack against the system that we Germans should regard as the one ray of light in a corrupt world. While the international world Jew slowly but surely strangles us, our so-called patriots lash out against the man and the system that have dared to withdraw from the Jewish Freemason embrace and to resist this spreading poison. But these weak characters could not avoid being blown in the wind of public opinion, and so they surrendered to its call. And a surrender it was. Though these people, in their wretchedness and lies, may not admit it, maybe not even to themselves, it is nevertheless the truth that only weakness and a fear of the temper of the masses, which was only stirred up by the Jew, made them take part in the outcry. All other explanations they offer are disgraceful excuses from the guilty little sinner himself. It was now necessary to yank the course of our movement around with an iron hand in order to preserve it from ruin by following this misguided trend. when the flame of public opinion is being fanned by every force that could drive it and is burning bright in one single direction, it is unpopular to follow a course in a different direction, and, in fact, often dangerous to the life of anyone who dares attempt such a course correction. Many men in history have been stoned for actions that future generations fell to their knees and thanked them for carrying through. That is why a movement must count on posterity to be its judge, and not the raging applause of the passing minute. Undoubtedly, we will find the individual suffering torment at those times when he must maintain a true course, but he must never forget that every such instant will be followed by redemption. A movement that is trying to reshape the world must serve the future and not the passing hour. We can easily say that some of the greatest and most long-lasting successes in all of history were the ones that were the least understood at their outset, because they were in sharp opposition to general public opinion, its views, and even its desires. We learnt this for ourselves at our first public appearance. We did not court the favour of the masses at our appearances, but instead we opposed the foolishness displayed everywhere by the people. During those years, I would appear before a group of people who believed the opposite of what I was saying and wanted the opposite of what I wanted. It would take 2 hours to lift 2,000 to 3,000 people out of their former convictions, to shatter the foundations of their established understanding, until, blow by blow, I finally led them to stand on the firm ground of our convictions and brought them to the side of our world concept. I quickly learned that it was important for me to knock the weapon of reality from my opponent's hand at the very beginning. We soon noticed that those who challenged us in open forums shared a very definite repertoire of constantly recurring objections. The uniformity of their replies made it obvious they had received special training from their masters. This is how we were able to recognize the incredible discipline in our adversaries' propaganda methods. I'm very proud, even today, that I was able to effectively counter their propaganda and eventually to best its creators at their own work. Within 2 years, I had become the master in the art of propaganda. It was important in every single speech to determine in advance what objections would be raised by the crowd. This way, these objections can be totally torn to pieces in the speech before discussion is even possible. It was always a good idea to bring up possible objections oneself, and then to prove how they were invalid or show that they did not apply. The listener who came in an honest spirit, and even though he was filled with the objections he had been trained to use, was then more easily won over by the preemptive rebuttal of the objections that had been stamped on his memory. Everything that had been drilled into him was automatically countered, which meant he was attracted more and more to the speech.
Tuned in to Radio Area.